Welcome to Supercharge, the Change and Comms podcast. In this episode, we're talking about big transformation with the wonderful Tracy Scotter. With Tracy in the house, it always feels a bit bright and exotic, like we should have a cocktail in our hands. And if it was a Tuesday, then I think this episode would have been called Tequila Tuesday. However, it's not. It's Friday, so it's Flaming Sambuca Friday.
Where's all this come from?
Pete, hello, how's things?
Fine, thank you.
These are real things. Tequila Tuesday, Margarita Wednesday, they are all original.
That's what we used to do all the time, obviously. We just left you out.
yeah, lockdown specials. Tracy, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
That's good. Let's get started straight away, because we do a podcast in the time it takes to drink a coffee or the average time of a UK commute, unless you're on the central line. So tell us a bit about your experience of working on big transformations.
I started working in IT a long time ago. And then when IT was delivering projects, it sort of became, and you've got to remember, this is like 30 years ago, it started to become apparent to people that this delivering a system was going to involve people change as well. I don't think that was really a concept understood before. I think people just thought they put in a system and off you went. So the work I did was started off being quite technical, doing all the project management and the sort of system solution and all that stuff, but eventually moved into the change side, which is the third piece of putting in change and making it successful. And so since then, some of the large projects I've worked on have been in the NHS. So that's been about putting in electronic patient records or various different systems. I put in the system where they introduced, believe it or not, digital photography that overtook X-rays. I don't know if you guys can even remember X-rays when they were on big sheets of acetate type paper. And if you were a patient, you had to carry your X-ray to places. And then the radiologists couldn't really believe that the digital photography would take over and do their job. And now, of course,
when was that? 1950s, was it?
No. I think that would be like, I didn't even join the NHS till 2004. So it's back in this century. But, you know, it would be in that kind of project, you'd have things like we put in digital photography and now it's moved to you can offshore all that radiology work, because we can just send it anywhere in the world. You take a photograph or an X-ray of a person and it goes off to a offshore site and people can do it. And now it's moving to AI because they're training robots to do radiology type work, because all you have to do is basically it's a learned thing. You're looking for abnormalities and all of that stuff. So they're now thinking that eventually people won't be involved in radiology at all.
Okay,
Which on one hand is quite good, because radiologists are really hard to recruit. But on the other hand it is good. It's technology change for you, but in the whole spectrum.
That's a change I don't think I'd fancy managing.
No, exactly. So it was funny. So an example there was when we did the consultation with the radiologists and the chief exec and I sort of stood up and started to talk about the project. There were more people who turned up to the consultation than we ever knew existed in the hospital. We had like hundreds more radiologists than we even knew about. And all these people were just like coming out from under stones and things. So, you know, when people feel threatened by something, they will definitely engage. And that was just another lesson as well.
It shows how AI reaches across so much, though, because we talk about it in like just, you know, tech organizations. But I suppose is the NHS a tech organization? I suppose that would be a transformation, but could be considered based on the amount of tech that they use, and that AI would play a big role. Are they a tech organization that does healthcare?
Yeah, well, they're definitely not right now, but that's part of that change piece, isn't it? If you look at what change involves for them to become a more digital organization, they need to be a more tech organization. They've got to develop those skills in data, in AI, in all of that stuff. I understand, but I don't know for sure, but they paid an absolute fortune to get those apps developed in COVID. And I don't know if you guys remember how long that took to get launched, and then how complex and difficult it was, and how they've all gone now. They've just not really, they didn't develop them with any form of continuity. But that all had to be brought in because they don't have those skills. They weren't responsive. They're not able to do that. And yet the possibilities of using AI are immense when it comes to health. I think it's going to have such incredible benefits. There's something in Russia where they've developed a kind of, it's like a wand, and they can just pass it over your body and then it takes all your vital statistics, does a scan of you, does all this stuff. And because it's there, they've collected everyone's health data from their local, you know, GPs or whatever they are. But They have an enormous population data, so they can compare you and they can see where you are on a spectrum and take it accordingly from there, you know, like give you intervention, help, whatever, say you're doing well, or all that kind of stuff. But really, it's the getting all that data in and then being able to use it to compare, contrast, and develop things further.
I suppose the benefit there, though, is if they have this magic wand, which sounds kind of Harry Potterish, but also terrifying, that you just happen to walk past what you think is a lamppost, and it's suddenly harvesting all of your data. But I suppose proactively, they're stopping illness before it becomes more expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're identifying it early, therefore the cost of treatment will be lower.
Yeah, so, and they can also get a more accurate diagnosis, because if you think about, like, loads of people don't get an accurate diagnosis, so we have wasted money on treatments and things. So if they can actually, so sometimes a GP will say, just go away and come back in 2 weeks if it hasn't gone. And then you get a certain number of people who've got really serious cancers. It's supposed to be like looking for a needle in a haystack, and it just won't all get spotted. So, and by 2 weeks' time, it can already have made a massive difference.
I guess what's interesting here is that you've got three people who work in change who've gone straight into the benefits of the technology and not focused on the nuts and bolts, which we wouldn't do.
Because obviously we're not in Russia and we're not in a kind of a control and dictate society, and people, we've got the general public to deal with, and we've got doctors and nurses and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
I think anybody over the years has probably read a few criticisms of NHS IT project delivery. I mean, we were just talking about one. And I wondered, actually, you've worked in different countries, different healthcare systems. Are the challenges that you tend to face in somewhere like the NHS the same, more or less, across the world? Or are there different cultural situations that might mean that people change differently?
I suppose the difference might be, so let's take the US, for instance, because I've recently been doing, I haven't been working in the US, but I'm working very closely with a number of US health organizations. We're trying to emulate what they're doing here in England. But in, you've got two big differences there. First of all, because it's private and because they're all companies that want to make money, they actually pay better salaries to IT people. So therefore, they have good IT skills and the skills they need to make things happen. In the UK, you've got quite relatively poor IT skills, and the people who work in IT in the NHS, so where I am now in central London, you know, why would you work in the NHS and earn 50 grand when you could be down the road in Barclays, in the stock exchange, in wherever, and be earning loads more? There are so many jobs, there's so much competition. So you're not paying a middle to top whack, so you're not getting the best people. And then secondly, in the NHS, it's all about people do what they want to do. So in the US, the doctors are told exactly what's going to happen, and then they have to comply with that. And that is actually the same here in private medicine. So I've worked in a hospital before in Manchester where there was a private hospital on the site and a NHS hospital, and the doctors would act one way in the private hospital because money was involved, compliance was involved, and they were just kind of told, right, we've moved to this system, you have to do this, this and this, and they just did it. And then they'd go,
the same people,
the same exact people working on the same site but in two different buildings. But when they go back to the NHS, because they have this thing allegedly called, I don't know if you guys, you will know this, the psychological contract.
Yeah.
People form with an organization, and people who work for the NHS generally, their psychological contract involves something like, I'm doing you a favor, I'm working, so a doctor, I'm working for less pay than I would get in the private sector. I'm great and amazing, and I'm giving you my services, and I'm doing it on my terms. But if you're paying them a lot more and they're going down the road to just do hip replacements or knee replacements or whatever, they just get on with it as a routine thing and lose their prima donna thinking.
That's so interesting. I guess there aren't many professions where you have people literally doing the same role in two different types of organizations, and see how they respond to that.
Yeah, because you could say, couldn't you, that, you know, what used to what I used to think when I first joined is that doctors just, you know, they couldn't be dictated to, they wouldn't comply, it was within their nature. But I've come to realize that's not right. That's true in the NHS. I mean, don't get me wrong, some people do, but they have to, they really have to see what's in it for them.
Do you think in that sense then that a future, I'm trying to think of the correct term, let's just go with like medicine professional, a medical professional, would also become a technologist?
That's a good question, because part of, you know, delivering change, I was just been reading an article by McKinsey, is that we often ignore the skill sets that are required after the change is in.
Yes.
So you're right. It's like, you know, you could be a doctor and absolutely not any form of technologist and a great doctor. But after we've made a lot of these changes, so some of the stuff we've just talked about now, the use of AI, the use of DNA and understanding that, the use of all these things, they need to be able to embrace that and become different kind of people. And they won't all have a natural bent towards that. They'll probably have a mistrust and all that stuff. So it's very much a, people think that the younger ones will be more, will more easily adapt because their lifestyle is different and they're...
There's an evolution, isn't there? Because I suppose when you have a medical professional who's starting to realise what AI, as an example, could do to help them, you know, the first generations of those toolings and technologies will be written for them. But when they understand it and they can start to see how they could actually exploit it for other purposes, it becomes more research-led. And therefore, you, by default, you want to become the technologist who can code those things. It's similar at the Met Office, where the scientist community are the ones who are looking at the models across the world in terms of heat, drought, you know, humidity, fire, and all these things. But they're writing the code and they're using the supercomputers and the other technologies that help bring the models to life. Yeah. And I imagine that healthcare will have to follow that in order to maintain its evolution.
I think that's a really good point as well, because that kind of leads to something like, that's about giving them a bit of time to do that, because I've done some work adopting Watson, you know, IBM's Watson, into a couple of specialties before. And what they discovered was that they had to spend so much time training it and actually getting it to be to work in the way that they would and in the way that would help them, that they were investing a huge amount of time in that, which was taking them away from their kind of activity and their practice. But if we'd allowed more time for them to do so, a lot of them just gave up in frustration, basically. You know, I haven't got the time to make this work really well. So I think as well as developing people's skill sets, you've got to give them time to get to make use of the tools and that kind of thing.
Did you see that they think they're looking at the statistics behind it, but humans have made ChatGPT dumber?
Yeah.
Did you see that article?
That. Yeah, so what in the questions it's asking?
So because it's like what it's supposed to learn, isn't it? The more that you put in, the better the answers get. But we're apparently just taking the first answer or something, and it's just making the thing, you know, less clever and less responsive and becoming less accurate. But I think I read that on LinkedIn, so you can probably take it with a pinch of salt. But it's quite a headline, isn't it? It's an attention-grabbing headline. Humans make AI dumber. I thought it was quite funny.
If I can just drag us away from AI a bit again, because it's something we go back to every week, I think, but Tracy, you've been in senior roles a lot, and I wondered if you could talk a bit, you know, when you're in that senior role and you're driving through changes, especially in healthcare where the impacts are quite significant, how do you kind of keep a picture across what's happening in the organization and, you know, keep everyone on the level?
Yeah, that is hard, really. And you definitely can't do that as a small team. You've got to reach out and engage people in it. And you've got to, so from a personal point of view, from a leadership point of view, I think you have to really do a lot of listening, not just talking, because you will hear the things back that are really bothering people. And you need to just draw out people who aren't talking as well so that you can get to hear what they've got to say. But and then it's about setting up tough conversations, I think, with people. So there'll always be worries and concerns. And in some way, you need to draw those out because it can't be glossed over. You know, it's that change curve thing, isn't it? And if people are going to be stuck down there at the bottom of being in denial, that's because they've got all those fears and worries and they need mechanisms to leave that behind. So I think the value of running various types of workshops, getting people to do exercises on what's the worst thing that could possibly happen and then how will we deal with that and get them to overcome some of their fears and things. And just as much communication and involvement as you can do. So in this online digital world, there's no excuse for not reaching out to loads of people. I mean, in the NHS, we use traditional stuff. But we do have weekly briefings. We have drop-in sessions. We have different kind of sessions for different things. So the briefings are information. The drop-in sessions are questions and answers. the kind of informal chats are more the how do I's and what will this mean for me and that type of stuff. So, but we've just set up a whole range of those, which we do run on Teams.
How much time do you give to that in a leadership role?
Well, for me, a lot, because my role is about leading on that change. But there are still people who don't see the value of it, who see it as something soft. And you have to really bring it home to them in terms of change impact.
Yeah.
So, you know, that the work that I'm currently doing now, there is going to be a lot of change impact in certain key areas. So, again, and there'll be change all over the place. But what we've had to do is identify our top areas where the impact will hit. And there's actually 50 of those. And then on those 50, it's making people realize that what it will look like tomorrow and how different that is what it is today, you know, and actually taking them through it. And if we didn't spend that time, then the lessons learned from the supplier that we're using who does the product, you know, they're called Epic basically at the moment. So they supply the system all around the world. 90-something% of US hospitals have it. If we don't get people ready for what the new world will be like on day one, there is no let up in this NHS. There's no soft launch. There's no like, okay, right, everyone, just don't be ill tomorrow. You know, it's just not going to happen. So you're going to have patients queuing out the doors, and it really will be chaotic if they don't understand the impact of the change. So there's a whole load of general stuff, and then there's the specific change impact stuff where we've really had to focus our efforts. And so you asked me about as in terms of leadership. It's about, for me, my role has been making people realize how important that is, how they absolutely have to get that right, and what would be the disbenefits or the problems of not getting it right, which really comes down to impact on patient care. The staff will get really frustrated. Our activity in the hospitals will go down, and therefore our income will go down. And we've currently got three top priorities. So getting this system in, so becoming digitized, but increasing activity. And most places where you put in an electronic system, the activity dips, it just will. But if it dips right down and you haven't prepared people, it takes a long time to recover. So that's a really key point as well. You might always have some form of chaos at go live, but if you have prepared people well enough, they'll recover quite quickly and just come out of it. If they're not prepared, then you're going to have endless task force running all over the place trying to sort out these problems and the problem areas.
I don't know if we explained it, but so the change you're talking about at the moment is digitizing patient data from paper-based systems to computerized, yeah. Right? And I think you said to me before, that's something like 150 different paper-based systems that you're trying to put into one.
Yeah, and they're not even just paper systems as well. They've got over 50 electronic systems that we are replacing with one. So what the system is actually doing is trying to create a single record for a patient. But in that record, it has their like GP data, their cancer data, their radiology data, their diet data, their neurology, you know, anything that they're involved in, so that you get this single look of a patient. And so all of the major specialties within the hospital are being replaced by this one system. It is absolutely massive. And it has in the past, the very first one they put in this country, which they did in Addenbrookes in Cambridge, then the chief exec got fired basically because the hospital ground to a halt.
Is it scary? The kind of change in some places you do, it doesn't really matter if things don't go as planned. But assuming the NHS, like you say, if you don't get it right, people are still going to come in ill the next day. How do you handle that? And you know, when you're doing impact assessments and things, where it's literally life or death.
Well, it does focus everybody's minds. And obviously, there has to be a kind of fallback position that you've got. So, and the data, that information that we can draw on is previous implementations of systems, or what I've found useful is actually previous cyber attack on hospitals, because once a hospital loses its main backbone of a system and has to resort to paper, and this did happen when I was at Sheffield, we had that WannaCry virus kind of broke out and disrupted everything. So people then worked out how long they could work for on paper. You know, like for some specialties, they could go for 2 weeks, but for others, they could only go for 4 days. And then we discovered as an IT department that surgeons were doing operations by being linked to the web and looking at certain, I mean, this isn't literally as bad as it sounds, but how to type videos. But they were accessing stuff that we didn't know about. We didn't realize they need that the link was so critical. So it's about identifying where all your kind of pinch points are going to be, and then how long people can manage without a system, and kind of being ready for that, really. But yeah, it is ultimately, it is really quite nerve-wracking.
Let's imagine you were recruiting for a role in your team and you were looking for a change manager. And it's a change manager, probably relatively new in their career, I'd say, sees, just thinks this looks really interesting. What's the type of things they should be preparing themselves for in terms of the challenges when they would start working in a, you know, a significant organisation the size of the NHS and the complexity of an organisation like the NHS? And then on top of that, putting a big transformation over the top of it. What would that change manager have to be thinking about and prepare themselves for?
Well, obviously you've got the sort of the skills of a change manager. So being able to do those things, and there isn't going to be an awful lot of time to learn on the job. So I think that being skilled at change management. So by that, I'm talking about change impact assessments, all the different pieces that you would put into sort of change management. You'd need to do that, but you'd need to also have a certain belief and confidence in what you're doing. And you very often still have to fight your corner to get people to realize how important change management is. So I think that that skill of being able to speak out, being able to challenge, being able to get people involved is really key. But then also being able to connect to the people that you're working with. So again, because our program is so massive, we've got kind of, can't remember how many, we've got lots of change managers. We've got change managers in about 25 different areas, and they've all formed relationships with the people who they work really closely with and earned their respect so that they can talk the same language and help them through this change. And then finally, I'd say being dedicated and just resilient in terms of rejection. So, you know, lots of our change people run workshops and they're really good. And the people who do attend get a lot out of them, but they're not always, they're still not turning up. That whole awareness piece and making people realize how important it is. I can guarantee you they'll be wanting to be learning more the minute we go live.
But yeah, that sounds very familiar.
I think having that tough chin and the broad shoulders would come probably after a few experiences of doing that. But if it sounds like for this type of role, you're going to have to go in pretty prepared to, yeah, you know, take the rough with the smooth.
Through your career, you've presumably been able to see people think about change management differently. So do you think, are there things that people do now, not from a technological perspective, but just from a people perspective, that people do differently than they did in the past? And have you seen that evolve through all the different things you've done?
Yeah, so I suppose if you think about going from virtually no change management at all to starting to realise the importance of it and starting to actually understand the change curve and things like the Cotter model, and the fact that I did once work somewhere, it was an American bank in Capital One, and they wanted to implement a really big change and they wanted it in as soon as possible. And they brought in all of the top six consultancies, Deloitte's, KPMG and the rest of them, and said, could they go from A to B without doing all the steps in between? And all six said, no, you cannot do that. You can't just go from this to that without doing that change management stuff, because A, you might just about pull something off at go live, but it won't stick. And so for me, and that was a long time ago, actually, but that was a really valuable lesson, that how important the work is and how much you really do need to do it. And then I guess the thing now is the current thinking is that, as I alluded to earlier, not everybody can change, right? So I think in the past 20 years, you might think, right, everyone's going to change. They'll become different. And they'll work differently and they'll just naturally embrace this. And I think now there's a big realization that that's not the case. So it's a bit like when you say the people who created the problems in an organization and not the people who can solve them necessarily, because they were part of that problem area. So you then have to now, I think, now weed out people who are going to be able to make the change, develop the skills you want and take them forward and look to buy in more skills or recruit the new types of skills that you want so that you've got that blend and you won't get everybody.
Yeah.
I just don't think that that's possible. So some people will be natural wastage, if you like. So they'll still be there, but eventually they're going to get so fed up, they won't see a future.
I mean,
so I think it's much more about, you know, accepting that and getting ready for it, basically, is a job of a change manager. It's not to think that everybody can get to that point B. They just can't, or they won't be relevant.
It's a tricky one, because I wouldn't set out with the mindset that definitely you're going to lose some people. But I think it's easy, you know, when you are doing scores and presenting that type of data, of, you know, we think we've got 50% of the people there, to misinterpret it as, oh, we're aiming for 100% of people must get the change, and then it's a success. You're right. I don't think that's always realistic, if anything.
No, it won't be, will it? Because some people will have really just been well suited to working in a certain way. So let's say take the switch from working in a sort of a DDO model to agile. Not everyone has an agile way of thinking. And to some people, that fail fast thing is scary. For the kind of prototyping, doesn't seem worthwhile. There's, you know, the actual nuts and bolts of it are not suited to their mindsets. Taking risks, you might have spent a long time keeping your workforce away from taking risks, and now you want to move into a different way of working because you've got a different set of tools to help you. If you don't address that, then you won't get the most out of your change, but equally, you just won't get everyone to change in that way.
Can I ask?
I find that a lot to compete.
I was going to change the topic quite considerably, so you should go first.
Well, I was going to talk about actually a couple of quick-fire questions, because I can see we're about one stop off of our destination point on our commute home. But you
okay,
go.
So mine's a true or false based on a conversation we had in a pub once. this could go a few ways, but is it true or false that you were once run over and then propositioned by Lemmy of Motorhead?
That is true, yeah. Yeah. And he sent me some flowers and all of that stuff. But it was those three moles that really just put me off, to be fair. I probably shouldn't have said that. But Lemmy, I think, will not be watching this podcast. And I hope everyone has.
You never know.
I don't know if I can on X or Twitter anymore. It seems to have reduced all of my abilities to do anything apart from just send a... Well, I don't know if it's, what do you call it? It's not, I put this on LinkedIn. It's not a tweet, is it? What is it? I put an X post on or something. A couple of quick fire questions for you then, Tracy. Which is your favourite industry you've worked in? Is it HE, higher education, NHS, healthcare, or banking? Which was your favourite?
I think that's really hard. So from a personal value and point of view, then the NHS, because you are actually making a difference.
Yeah, but for the parties, banking, I get it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, you know, we would just put thousands behind a bar and celebrate a project go live, and that would be it.
Right, next quickfire question. Brighton or Crystal Palace?
Oh, God, Crystal Palace. Palace now. I've been going to the matches and everything.
Yeah. No, we all have our problems, I guess. Margarita or Sambuca?
Margarita, every time.
And what's your favourite biscuit?
I don't eat biscuits.
What? No, you don't.
No, I just
don't. You're not. Honestly, Pete, when we used to sit in one of the uni buildings and there was just the two of us in there some days, and Tracy would rock up with a lunch, and it would be the most elaborate salad or pasta or, you know, rice dish. I don't know. And it would just stink. I'm sorry, Ray, but it did. And garlic and fishes. Yeah. And he loved the seasoning. But, there was never
any
in
biscuits.
Sight, was there? Never any biscuits. Occasionally a brownie would rock up, but never a biscuit.
No,
surely
really.
In the NHS, that's a staple diet, isn't it?
It is. They just have... Oh, they have endless amounts of junk. They have pizza, they have biscuits. And obviously, I'm lucky enough to work in a WeWork now, right? So we have
wee
beer, we have all these things on tap.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you for your time, Tracy. I know you have a very busy afternoon ahead of you at WeWork.
Yeah, and then I'm going to see Noel Gallagher tonight.
Are you?
Yeah. The High Flying Birds in Crystal Palace Park.
Just make sure he doesn't run you over.
Yeah, I'm sure. And if he did, he probably just wouldn't even look twice, would he? He'd just be like, old lady, run over.
Brought back to life via tequila.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks so much,
everyone. Bye.